Hey everyone, welcome in to our latest episode of the Vasculitis Visionaries Podcast. Ben Wilson with you once again. Kaylee Bynes, as always, alongside as my co-host. Kaylee, you have a new job, so congratulations on that. Let's not bury the lead before we get into our podcast. Since you do have your master's in public health and you do work in the medical field, it's not irrelevant to our podcast. So why don't you tell our listeners what your new gig is?
Sure. So I just got a position with the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. So I'm sticking to the sciences side, not so much medicine, but doing a lot of toxicology work, so chemical exposure and disease development. So tangentially related.
Oh yeah, more than tangentially. I mean, we are very proud. That is awesome. I'm not surprised at all to hear of this news. So congratulations. It's also impressive that you got a job during a pandemic. You can have that on your ledger. So
I'll add it to my resume.
yeah, exactly. So that is great news. Also, what was good news for all of our listeners is the episode you're about to hear, because, you know, we had one episode a couple months ago that talked about a new form of vasculitis and kind of some new research when we talked to Dr. Grayson with the whole RP conversation. And this kind of falls in the same realm, a little bit more unique, and we'll get into this as we discuss it, but it is the Dada 2 Foundation that we're going to be talking about, and we'll be joined here shortly by Drs. Chip Chambers and Pui Lee, who have both played critical roles in the development in this research, really over the last 5 to 6 years. It's a very new thing. I think the first study was published back in 2014 in the New England Journal. So, Kaylee, I know it's something that has really interested you. Just anytime you think about a new type of disease and how it differentiates itself from some of the other types of vasculitis, and again, we'll get into this, but it's an interesting one. I know you can speak a little bit more about the background of Drs. Chambers and Lee, but it's been impressive to see so quickly how they've been able to find out a lot about this, and there's already been some incredible developments, as we're going to get into shortly.
Definitely. So we have Dr. Chip Chambers, as you mentioned, who is the head of the Dada 2 Foundation, but also has a background as a surgeon. And also Dr. Pui Lee, who is a rheumatologist, but focuses on pediatric rheumatology. And he teaches at Harvard Medical School and also is at Boston Children's Hospital. So some more rock stars for all of our listeners. Definitely very interesting. I think I'm used to the very straightforward vasculitis charts that there are out there, splitting it up into small, medium, large vessel vasculitis and kind of looking at it like that. But the really interesting part of Dada 2 is that it is genetically linked very clearly and differently from a lot of the vasculitis that we've seen and discussed so far. So this should be a really fascinating episode.
Yeah, and not just genetically. There's a number of characteristics that differentiate this particular disease than what you see a lot of in the typical different types of vasculitis that we are all used to learning about and researching. So I think for our medical professionals who listen to this, it is going to be a really insightful and a podcast that I hope teaches everybody something new. I certainly had not heard of this before, so I'm looking forward to it. We'll have Dr. Lee here in Boston, Kaylee, of course, in the D.C. Area, I guess Rockville, technically, in Maryland. I want to make sure I'm right on that. As always, we'll have Dr. Chambers in Nashville, and I'm here on the West Coast in Las Vegas. So we'll get right to it. Drs. Chip Chambers and Pui Lee coming up next right here on the Vasculitis Visionaries Podcast. Okay, let's welcome in our guests now into this latest episode of the Vasculitis Visionaries Podcast. We have Dr. Chip Chambers joining us from Nashville, Dr. Pui Lee out in the Northeast in Massachusetts. So I want to thank both of you for joining us. I know it's just a crazy time, and I think of what we've talked about. You know, we had Dr. Grayson on our podcast a couple months ago, Dr. Peter Grayson, who I know you both are very familiar with, and something we were talking about was his recent development in research for RP and how that relates and some of the differences there between GPA and RP within the vasculitis community. So it's something I want to get into when we talk about
what your recent research over these past few years has covered. Before we get into that, though, just wanted to get more of the background from you as far as providing us kind of the context for how your research has come about. I know everybody has a different story. Everybody is, again, it's a little bit unique in how you get into this. So we'll start with you, Dr. Chambers, and then we can go to you, Dr. Lee, if you want to just give us the version of how you've entered into this the spectrum and how it led you into this this current research, which, like I said, we'll get into here in a little bit.
Ben, thank you very much. Same here, Kaylee. Thank you as well. And it's going to be a little strange how I got into this. And I'm a surgeon by training, and specifically, I'm the former chief of endocrine surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And you would normally not hear a general surgeon talking about vasculitis. They may be talking about vascular disease that requires surgical intervention, but certainly not vasculitis. However, both of my children were diagnosed with a rare disease, a monogenic rare disease in 2014 called DADA2. It stands for deficiency of adenosine deaminase 2, and it was discovered by Dr. Dan Kastner, who is the scientific director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the NIH, and by a group in Jerusalem. They simultaneously published articles in the New England Journal. And after a 15-year hunt for what was wrong with my daughter, and then now my son was getting sick, we got that diagnosis almost simultaneously when we saw those articles come out. So it's quite interesting. I've spent my 30-plus years in medicine, in general surgery and then as a super specialist in thyroid cancer. But now I sort of consider myself an armchair rheumatologist, immunologist, geneticist, dermatologist, hematologist. And thankfully, people like Dr. Lee, who are truly rheumatologists, tolerate me. But it is a unique position of being a physician and being a father of two children with a rare disease, and then using my medical knowledge, but my other knowledge to run the foundation as well. We formed the DADA2 Foundation in 2016 is when it was formed. And I remember distinctly one of the first people that I contacted about coming to the meeting was Joyce Cullum, the CEO of the Vasculitis Foundation. And she and several other people from the Vasculitis Foundation have come to the 18 meeting, and we're planning the 2020 meeting. So there's been a great collaboration between the DADA2 Foundation and the Vasculitis Foundation. I'm just thrilled that you asked us to participate in this podcast today.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're grateful for both of you coming on and kind of mentioning, it ties in to you, Dr. Lee, with your rheumatology background. I'm curious just the intersection of all of this too, and for you, how you you came into this as well.
Sure. First, thank you, Ben, and thank you, Kaylee, for inviting us. It's great to be here. So I am a pediatric rheumatologist at Boston Children's Hospital. So for a long time, I've been interested in autoimmune diseases. As a graduate student, I was working on lupus. So I was working on lupus for quite a long time. And after finishing my clinical training, when I was still a fellow, actually, I ran across a case where a little girl, 2-year-old girl, was having many features of what we call autoinflammatory disease, where she's got lots of fever, lots of rashes, but we just couldn't figure out what she had at the time. And after a few months, she developed 2 episodes of stroke, which is highly unusual in that population. So she was the first case of DADA2. This is the disease Tripp just described, diagnosed at Boston Children's Hospital. That was just about 9 months after the initial paper described it from the NIH. So I found that to be fascinating. And through the workup with that patient, I was able to get connected with Chip and the NIH and many other specialists that have some knowledge of this condition. So that's the point where I decided to do some research work on it. So now I've been taking care of all the DADA2 patients in the New England area, which we've found a good number since just a few years ago. And a big part of my lab is focusing on thinking about how the mutations in ADA2 cause this condition, and how the different mutations are connected to the different phenotype of disease, which we can speak later about. There are many different manifestations of this very fascinating condition.
Well, thank you again, just to echo Ben, for both being on. Just to follow up, Dr. Lee, on your explanation about a little bit about this disease, there seems to be some difference of opinion in the literature about whether DADA2 can be classified as vasculitis. And I know, Dr. Chambers, you talked about the collaboration between our two organizations in the past. And Dr. Lee, do you consider DADA2 to be vasculitis? Would you make a distinction between the two? Would you consider it under the umbrella? How would you classify it?
Yeah, I would certainly classify many patients with DADA2 as having vasculitis. And the debate really is because there are manifestations of DADA2 that are totally disconnected from what we think typically for vasculitis. So for example, there's a subset of patients, they develop mostly a bone marrow problem, or they don't make white blood cells, or they don't make red blood cells. And many of these patients do not have features of the vasculitis type of symptoms. So there's a subset that, you know, so far we haven't really found the vasculitis manifestations. But I would say in the majority of cases, they do have different findings of vasculitis, so including skin vasculitis. Many have internal organ vasculitis of the gastrointestinal tract, and many have stroke that are disproportionate to what we've seen in most other settings, even in terms of vasculitis. So especially in the skin, so we do a biopsy of the rash in DADA2, often it looks indistinguishable from PAN, polyarteritis nodosum. So I would consider it an umbrella vasculitis syndrome, with the asterisk that, you know, some patients to develop a slightly different phenotype, mainly affecting the bone marrow.
Yeah, Kaylee, this is Dr. Chambers. I would just add to that, it's been fascinating. You know, we don't know what we don't know in medicine, so we didn't know this disease existed until 2014, and I think what we're finding is a lot of people that were classified with PAN, you know, indeed don't have PAN. They in fact, have DADA2. This is even true in the bone marrow failure phenotype. There's another disease called diamond black anemia, which has been around for years, where the bone marrow of children doesn't work. And if the patient didn't meet the classical description for that, they still said, oh, it must be diamond black anemia. However, again, we're finding that some of these patients indeed had DADA2. So it's always interesting how medicine and science advance. And then as we learn those advancements, we look back to our patients and say, could it be that that patient may have this new disease, even though we had them classified as a PAN patient for some time? So it's very fascinating.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, you think about how recent all this is. I mean, we're talking in the sphere of the medical community, basically a 6-7 year stretch, which is just it's microscopic on the grand scale. So it has been amazing to see. And kind of how I was mentioning earlier, you know, we had Dr. Grayson on explaining just some of the incredibly subtle differences between the GPA and the RP as far as that research goes. Dr. Lee, I'm sure you've looked at this extremely closely. Some of those, again, individual, and I know you mentioned one of them a moment ago, but some of those really tiny characteristics that I'm guessing you're having to look at on a really deep level to tell apart these two diseases. What have been some of those, and are any of those things that kind of surprised you as you began looking into this more in depth?
I think one of the important part about diagnosing DADA2 is the treatment can be very different in terms of the response compared to PAN. PAN, as you know, is also a systemic vasculitis, and it's often difficult to treat. And we see that mostly in adults. We don't see PAN very much in children, fortunately, but there are still occasional cases of that. DADA2, as it stands, it explains a good fraction of PAN cases in children. And we're finding more and more of these cases in adult-onset disease also. So even in adults, when they're diagnosed as PAN, there's some chance that those could be individuals with DADA2 as well. The key difference comes in the treatment. When there is a DADA2, when the patients have mutations in DADA2 and they have the PAN-like phenotype of vasculitis, they're very responsive to treatment with TNF inhibitors. So this is tumor necrosis factor inhibitors, versus we don't really think about that as first or second line treatment in the setting of PAN. So making the right diagnosis quickly makes a huge difference in terms of getting on the right medicine. And once they're, for DADA2 patients, once they're on TNF inhibitors, most of their inflammatory features will get better. And most importantly, the kids are protected from getting further strokes.
Definitely a huge distinction to talk about how the treatment, how the treatment really can differ so much, even though the symptoms are fairly similar in terms of presentation, at least sometimes. One thing that's really always interested me just in terms of vasculitis, especially ANCA-associated vasculitis, given that I have DPA, is the potential for triggers. I'm really interested, especially in environmental triggers, but just really trying to figure out what caused the onset of my disease and my symptoms. And since SADA 2 appears to be really more clearly genetically linked than ANCA-associated vasculitis, how does that affect its pathogenesis? If patients have this gene mutation, will they always develop SADA 2, or does it depend in certain circumstances? How does that work?
Certainly a very interesting question. And we deal with this not just for SADA 2, but almost every monogenic disease across the board for thinking about it in rheumatology. Certainly it's true that having two mutations for ADA2 will sort of help make claim the diagnosis. But the age of onset varies widely. So for the vasculitis features, most patients will develop some features as during their childhood. So I think the onset age is about age 4 to 5. But the range of symptoms can be just a rash to profound impact of having strokes, recurrent strokes. And there are individuals that develop these symptoms very early, like age 1 or age 2 even. And then there are family members actually with similar genetics, the same mutation setup, and not have any symptoms well into adulthood. So I echo your comment that there are certainly environmental factors here that we have not been able to identify yet. Perhaps infections and the trigger to the inflammatory response is a factor, as we've seen a number of cases where the kids became ill after an infection of some sort, and that there's a prolonged symptoms that led us to the track of looking for the genetics and finding a diagnosis. At the same time, I mentioned earlier that there are patients with a more hematologic phenotype where they have bone marrow failure. Those patients tend to present much earlier in life, often in their first year of life. And we don't quite understand the differences yet at this stage, so I'm sure there's much more research that needs to be done to understand that.
Yeah, Kaylee, this is Dr. Chambers again. It's the one phenotype we haven't talked about so far is immunodeficiency. So I like to put it in three buckets. This disease has autoinflammation, which can result in the vasculitis. It can have immunodeficiency. That's like the bubble boy, but not that bad. But still, the children have to be on gamma globulin replacement. And then you have the bone marrow failure, as Dr. Lee said. And what's just unbelievable, we refer to this as heterogeneity. The patients can have a little bit of all of those, or just one, as he described, and not the other. Or frankly, we found patients, like you said, within families that definitely have both mutations for an autosomal recessive disease, but yet by all clinical criteria, they're asymptomatic. I think both Dr. Lee and Dr. Kastner and others feel like that this is a very unique thing that they have found in this autoinflammatory disease, as it's sometimes classified, versus other autoinflammatory diseases like FMF or it's familial Mediterranean fever, or some of these others that are strictly autoinflammatory. This disease crosses boundaries. Your initial presentation could be as a child with a stroke in an emergency room, or you could be going to the dermatologist because you have this little nodule on your leg. So it really requires the doctors to really be on their toes to think about the diagnosis.
And I would also, just talk to you again, John, I'll jump back and add on that. I think part of it is being aware of this. I think this was discovered in the context of having many children with stroke and features vasculitis. And therefore, the condition is much more well known among pediatric providers. And the literature is not out there for many adult providers for the first few years. So we're just now beginning to reach out to the adult providers. So our recent study in collaboration with Dr. Aman Sharma and others in India found that In India, you know, in the first 33 cases of data to be found there, half of these patients were well into their adult. So it's not simply a pediatric onset type of vasculitis or syndrome. There are many patients out there that we just have, they don't have the severe features, and therefore they have not been identified yet, even as adults.
So that's a really good point that I also think is fascinating in terms of vasculitis as an umbrella, is how long people go before really getting treated. And as you both mentioned, a lot of that can be just in terms of, you know, what do doctors know in terms of diagnosis? Are they looking for the right thing? But I do think it's fascinating that you did mention, you know, maybe people aren't getting diagnosed for an extended period of time, even though they have had this presentation for a while. So in terms of the patients that you've seen and the research that you've done, is it for, I guess, the non-pediatric patients, does it seem that people have had symptoms of a while and just, you know, as with Dr. Chambers, children just waited a long time to get answers for this? Is that what you're seeing?
It's quite variable, because sequencing is much more available now. When we had cases that are not completely fitting to the known boxes in pediatrics, now providers, especially specialists, are much quicker in terms of getting to send genetic panels and try to identify the various genetically related syndromes. And we also know that there are most, even though the different syndromes have the sort of a described list of associated symptoms and manifestations, but often these also grow out of the box a little bit, right? Sometimes we have surprises where present of a certain syndrome is not classic. So because it's quite available to do this genetic testing now, I don't think that there's significant delay now in terms of getting to the diagnosis. But there are cases from before where, you know, before we had the sequencing available, or also before we even know about this disease that's been hanging around. So, for example, one of the data 2 patients I've started treating recently has been following our hospital for almost 10 years. And it was not a disease 10 years ago. So therefore it's quite likely that people didn't know. But many years later, it started to put the picture back into place that we can sort of solve the puzzle.
Yeah, and it's just amazing too, thinking about how for at least every other individual subset of vasculitis I've ever, read about or learned about, it's almost the exact opposite of what we're talking about, where it's almost all adult to a late onset adult type symptoms, and you see very few pediatrics, and that's kind of where, like, you're thinking about the Vasculitis Foundation, where that it intersects, how, like, I know we're working on developing an entire website just for pediatric vasculitis, because it's been such an under-covered and underrepresented part of the community, just based on the lack of cases. So I wonder if it's, is it just a coincidence to think that we're all of a sudden looking at this disease that feels like it has the exact opposite characteristics, at least in the preliminary data, where it's all focused on pediatrics, which, again, I'm sure that has kind of played into, you're looking into vasculitis as a whole. We just generally think of, all right, there just aren't as many pediatrics who have different types, whether you're looking at GPA, EGPA, PAN, whatever it is. How much of that do you think can kind of shape future research as we kind of, we kind of transition this discussion into looking forward and what are kind of the things we can do now to advance this? I don't know, that kind of jumps out to me as something that, I don't know, maybe is something to look at. I'm sure for you, Dr. Chambers, and it's, for Kaylee and I, we're both patients. It's been very personal for us. I'm sure for you and mentioning your involvement, very personal for you as well. And it has led to a lot of this research. Did you find that at all interesting, seeing just the differences in this, the specific types of people being, again, very early on, but being diagnosed as compared to a lot of these other vasculitis that we see, and just the type of the type of people that in general get diagnosed with other types of vasculitis?
Yeah, so it does change our view quite a bit. In pediatrics, the vasculitis that we're mostly attuned to are, one's Kawasaki disease and the other one is HSP, right, or IgA mediated vasculitis. And both of those seems to be quite easily picked up based on the pattern we recognize. And with treatment, they almost all of them do quite well. This is a sort of a new form of vasculitis that we're seeing. And it takes much longer follow-up. It certainly is a chronic condition, right? It's a lifelong condition. And once we start medicine, we're talking about a lifetime, right, of treatment. In some cases, they can be treated with bone marrow transplant. Compared to sort of other cases that the other type of vasculitis we see in pediatric, so the GPA, EGPA, tachyosis, arteritis, those are relatively rare also. We have not seen so many of those. So you're absolutely right. This is sort of going backwards, right? So usually we learn many of these vasculitides from the adult world. So how we treat GPA, EGPA, are much based on the adult literature. And this is the one scenario where we're often showing the way in terms of how adults should help diagnose and help manage these patients. One of the most important part of the discussion is certainly making a diagnosis quick. The faster we make the diagnosis, the faster we get them on the right medicines to prevent some of the terrible outcomes that can be associated with DATA2. And I think Chip can go into this also. And fortunately for DATA2, there's an additional test that's available in addition to genetic testing. Genetic testing is great, but it often takes weeks to result. And sometimes the result may be difficult to interpret with these variants that have not been found before. But the DATA2 has additional tests where you can test for the activity of the protein product in the blood. So there's a enzyme test that can be done. It can quickly tell you whether the enzyme is present or absent to make the diagnosis that way. So having this test available to different parts of the world will be key in terms of making this diagnosis early for these patients.
That's really incredible in terms of being able to move away from just genetic testing, given especially the cost in our healthcare system. I think that's really, I mean, at least from my perspective, that's life-changing and game-changing, really, to have that kind of test. In terms of just like those patterns that you mentioned in adults versus pediatric cases and what you're looking for, I'm also curious about the split between sexes. So I think generally in the literature, autoimmune diseases tend to skew female, although for vasculitis, especially systemic vasculitis, we've really seen that the split is more 50-50. So have you seen any data for DATA2, and what does that look like in terms of sex and gender split?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as a pediatric rheumatologist, we often deal with lupus and arthritis and many conditions where we do see this female predominance. For DATA2, however, because it is more of a genetically driven disease, it's an autosomal recessive disease, meaning we have mutation coming from both sides of the family, right, to cause the condition. It is pretty much an even 50-50 split in terms of the data that we have available to us. So both female and male are affected equally.
And, you know, the other thing I've been thinking about as well with this, and we mentioned this in our intro. I'll mention it again, and we'll link to this when we post the podcast, your website, data2.org, which has a lot of great resources and info. But I mean, I think about how so many different types of vasculitis we have seen, an amazing amount of new treatments being developed here over the past couple of years. I'm sure for both of you, Dr. Chambers and Dr. Lee, you're hoping that this kind of follows the same trend as a lot of other diseases in the vasculitis community as far as treatments and such. So I know you, Dr. Lee, you mentioned the TNF inhibitors and thinking though too about just the prevalence and the rise of biologics within our community as a form of treatment. I wonder what sort of research has been done into that, especially when you think about these different interleukin inhibitors that can sometimes be set off. It seems like, as you mentioned, there's some evidence that in this particular disease, there definitely is some involvement there, and certainly in other diseases like in EGPA, for instance, where these biologics have been able to, you know, shut down these different these overproducing IL inhibitors and kind of control the disease that way. Is there anything to that you've investigated so far? And I guess in general, what does the current treatment research kind of trend towards as far as where you guys are looking for in the future?
Sure, that's a great question. So the reason, or I guess the cause of inflammation for this disease is still not completely clear. There's several sort of hypotheses in the field, and there are many different groups that have worked on it, including Dr. Grayson, who you mentioned earlier. The overwhelming finding so far is that TNF seems to be a major player for this disease. And even though we cannot measure it in the blood. So if you measure TNF, the levels are typically, you know, normal. You really do not see the high level of TNF, but blocking the cytokine seems to be sort of provides really excellent response in the treatment of the inflammation associated with DATA2. And in a major landmark study from the NIH group, where they had a good number of patients that have multiple strokes before treatment, after they got on TNF inhibitors, they really do not have any more strokes. So that's the type of response we're seeing, not just in NIH, but really across the world in terms of the efficacy of the TNF inhibitors. Other treatment, blocking other pathways, IL-1, IL-6, they've all been trialed. It's less successful compared to TNF based on the data that's available. So at the current time, I think most people in the field would agree that for the vasculitis associated with DATA2, TNF inhibitor is the first-line treatment. Now, it does have its share of challenges also for children, right? So once you start this medicine, especially, because this is a genetic condition, there is no endpoint. We cannot change the genetics. So once we start treatment for TNF inhibitor, it's a lifetime. At this time, we don't know when would be safe to stop, and we certainly do not want to put anyone at risk for stroke or developing vasculitis again once they are in remission. Challenge going forward is understanding what is the underlying basis of the disease, where's the TNF coming from, and are there other ways to solve the inflammatory puzzle in this condition without a lifetime of medicine. And Tripp will go into a little later about other research going on now in terms of gene therapy and enzyme replacement and other approaches that may be useful. But for now, this is the best treatment we have, even though there are some challenges. Another point I want to know is in certain parts of the world, right, TNF inhibitor is less benign. So in India, we do have patients that we have seen getting tuberculosis, right? Because TNF inhibitors, one of the major side effects is immunosuppression, right? Putting people at risk for a different infection. So we have had DATA2 patients that developed tuberculosis while they're on treatment with TNF inhibitors. So it's a great treatment. I think this is the first line for DATA2 for most clinicians across the world at this point. But we're certainly hoping to have more research in the area and develop better treatment going forward.
Yeah, guys, you know, it's very interesting since we're talking medicine and science. Again, DATA2 is a rare disease. That means an incidence of less than 1 in 200,000. Of course, we really don't know how many DATA2 patients there are. We're working on that. But it's funny. The disease, remember I said, was discovered at the NIH by Dr. Kastner and a group in Jerusalem, Israel. And just to show you how non-scientific medicine can be, Dr. Kastner at the NIH was not thinking of using TNF inhibitors at all. In fact, he was trying to give the patients fresh frozen plasma, blood plasma, which has the enzyme in it. It wasn't very successful. When the Israelis published the paper at the same time, there was literally one sentence in that paper that said, you might try TNF inhibitors. So obviously we were all on the phone with them. Well, as it turned out, they had been following a group of Georgian Jews for almost 30 years. And that's a Jewish sect that intermarries. And so they knew the disease was genetic, but as Dr. Lee said, now it's relatively cheap, but at the time it was, tens of thousands of dollars to do sequencing. So they just kept following the patients, and they actually referred to it as Georgian Pan at the time. However, there was this little 2-year-old boy that was in the pediatric intensive care unit, essentially dying from perforated intestine due to this vasculitis. And there was a child next door. I don't know what was wrong with the child, but he was getting the drug infliximab, which was one of the first TNF inhibitors to come along, and it's given intravenously, and they had some left over. To this day, it just astounds me. They had some left over, so they decided to give it to this little Georgian Jewish boy, and he started to get better. And so that's how it came to be that TNF inhibitors were used to treat DATA2. The vast majority of the 7,000 rare diseases out there, there's treatment for less than 5%. So how lucky we were that after the disease was described. Of course, Dr. Kastner immediately began switching the patients to TNF inhibitors. And as Dr. Lee said, they produced data to show that in the patients that were having strokes, not one of their cohort has had a stroke since going on the drug. So basically a miracle drug. If you were a mother and a father of a DATA2 kid and he had had 5, 6, 7 strokes, and you're just waiting for the next big stroke to possibly take his life, that would be considered a miracle drug. But it was all by serendipity. We began studying maybe how TNF works sort of after the fact that we just knew the Israelis had just tried it. I'll use the word willy-nilly since I'm from the South, and it worked. But just a fascinating, fascinating story. And that little boy, by the way, is almost 20 now. I have a picture of him. He's doing great and he's gone on with his life. So quite a story.
Yeah, that's truly amazing. And I feel like stories are similar, that kind of abound throughout the vasculitis community, but especially, I mean, you talk about something as new as this and you think about, yeah, the way that it is, has furthered different amounts of knowledge and research. It's kind of hard to overstate. The level of the amount that it had to take to get to this point. And I think too, I mean, it definitely seems like a correlation when you look at, especially for something as small as this, and this is definitely a growing thing with the DATA2 Foundation as we learn more about it. But to have someone like you, Dr. Chambers, I mean, you have your kids diagnosed with this and you're somebody who you're dealing with it on. It's very central to not only you in the medical field, but like you mentioned, just your involvement with this. So, how have they done? What have you seen? Again, knowing that we have so few cases of this, at least that have been diagnosed so far, I'm sure it's been interesting for you looking at your kids both from, the perspective as a dad and you're trying to take care of them and see how they react to these different treatments, but also thinking in the sphere of, all right, well, how can this maybe help and impact future people who are diagnosed? I'm sure that has to be kind of a unique intersection on your end.
Yeah, as I said, my daughter had been sick for 15 years and she was getting worse. In fact, so worse, so bad that we were actually considering a bone marrow transplant on her, even though we didn't know why we would have been doing that. There was no diagnosis. And, when we went to the NIH just immediately after those papers were published in February and March. So by June, we were at the NIH seeing Dr. Kastner, who discovered the disease. And, there was no question at that time he wanted to put my children on TNF inhibitors. My son had developed symptoms later, so he was not as bad a situation as my daughter. And I asked Dr. Kastner, I said, do you think we really ought to go ahead and put this, drug on him now? And he said, absolutely. And it's made a dramatic difference. My daughter, her senior year of high school, missed 50 days, but still graduated remarkably and was self-taught at home a lot, but the school was fine with that. And, I really didn't know what her future was going to be, but after going on these drugs, she was able to ultimately go on to college. She's now getting her master's in English. So it's made a dramatic difference. Does it ameliorate all of the symptoms? And in our family, the answer is no. She still struggles with GI complaints. She still struggles with fatigue, which we saw in a lot of the patients. But it has made a dramatic difference in her life. And we're just so thankful because I frankly think my daughter may have been headed for a stroke. It just was a question of when. So she has not had a stroke. And since going on the drug, as I say, she's improved. So we really feel fortunate, just like all those other families out there.
Yeah, no doubt. I think Kaylee and I can both, speak to this too, where, you get diagnosed and even after finding some sort, the treatment that works, there's still always something, I guess, is the way I phrase it as a patient. There's always going to be something that's going on. But at the same time, and you're from the patient's end, you think about where you were and you kind of think about, as dark as saying, like, you think to your darkest day and all that, but you really do base off that previous experience to just feel like, okay, well, maybe we still have some issues going on, but at least we've got the main thing controlled. And that definitely, and Kaylee, I know you feel the same way. It definitely rings true. And we think about, just the overall development of our vasculitis research that we've seen in the community. as a whole. And you know, hearing something like that, though, for as young and as recently as we've heard about something like this with Dada too, does give reason for optimism that there is a way out of this. It seems like for a lot of people that are diagnosed.
Well, and that's the very exciting thing. So, you know, the Dada 2 Foundation, we're there to facilitate, just like the Vasculitis Foundation. So we're there to pull researchers and families and patients together. At our 2018 conference, we had 123 physicians from 25 countries, including Japan, Saudi Arabia, China. But just as importantly, we had 93 patients and families from 13 countries, including Palestine, Japan, et cetera. And that's really the key. And the key is really so important to have that collaboration, because there are possibly some cures out there for Dada 2. I mean, that word cure is not thrown around in medicine too lightly. And as we've said, most diseases are chronic, but, you know, we have had, as Dr. Lee mentioned, several patients who have had bone marrow transplants because they've had the bone marrow failure phenotype or type of Dada 2. And for all practical purposes, they appear to be cured. There's a little boy in the Netherlands that was transplanted at 6 months of age. And these phenomenal doctors, once these papers were published, they saw them and they said, I wonder if that little patient that I transplanted 6 years ago may have had this disease. So they scraped his cheek, because you can't use the blood because it's not his blood. And they ran the genetic testing, and sure enough, he had it. And he's doing well. He's now almost 10 years out and doing fine. And we've had other more recent transplants. However, transplant is not a walk in the park. It's a very intense procedure where you give enough chemo to wipe out somebody's bone marrow and then replace it. But yet there are some patients out there that I think we can honestly say are cured of Dada 2 from undergoing that procedure. But what's come out of those conferences is some great collaborations around the globe for looking at gene therapy. And when you look at this disease where it appears to only be one gene, the ADA2 gene, then gene therapy of correcting that defect, correcting one of those little base pairs out of the, 3 billion that we have, correcting a few of those in theory would work. And then thus what would happen is you would go back to making ADA2, because that's the problem. This genetic defect, you can't make ADA2. And what these kids need is not TNF inhibitor. They need it as the treatment, but to cure them, they need ADA2. And so there's been some phenomenal work at Great Ormond Street, very famous children's hospital in London, and at San Rafael Institute in Milan, Italy, on gene therapy, where outside the body, it appears that we've been able to take some cells from patients and do gene therapy outside of the body and actually have those cells make ADA2. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it would work in the body. So there's a lot of work still to be done to prove that it could be done in a human. But it's very, very, very exciting. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, the fact that maybe in the future at some point, the treatment for Dada 2, no matter which phenotype you have, it could possibly be gene therapy, depending on the risk and benefits. And then I've also been working on trying to develop an artificial ADA2 that you could just infuse into patients. And there's progress on that front as well. But again, as Dr. Lee said, that would be a lifelong treatment. It would be nice to tell the patient you're cured and you don't have to take any other drugs for Dada 2 moving forward. So, and not to mention the expense. I mean, staying on drugs for lifelong is incredibly expensive. Gene therapies are expensive, but if it cures the patient, probably from an economic perspective in healthcare, you're still winning from that perspective. So we really feel fortunate to have this incredible community of physicians, researchers, biotech, pharma, but most importantly, patients and families working together for that goal.
It's unbelievable that in 10 years it went from discovered to potentially cured. That's just kind of blowing my mind from a scientific perspective.
Yeah, Caitlin, I'll tell you, it's amazing. When we had the conference in 2016, at the time, far as we knew, it was the soonest a conference of that scale had occurred after the discovery of a rare disease. And so, you know, I think I have a passion. I mean, DATA2 is a passion, but I really, as a physician, I sit in this unique perspective because we're able to sequence your genome now for pennies practically compared to what we did before. So we're on the precipice of discovering a lot of genetic diseases. But as we know in medicine, science, and as you guys know, just because you know the genetic defect doesn't mean you know even what protein may or may not be affected. And even if you know the protein, that doesn't mean you know how that protein interacts in the human body such that you can develop a therapy for it. So, the one I always use is sickle cell anemia, where we knew the genetic defect for sickle cell anemia 30 years ago, 35 or so now probably. But only now are we talking about treatments that could possibly cure it. So one of my other big mantras is we've got to look at this differently in medicine. We've got to be able to, we can't just have this, all these genetic diseases discovered and tell a mama that, yes, here's the genetic disease your son has, but they're going to die at age 10 and sorry, I can't help you. To me, and I know to Dr. Lee and I know to Dr. Castor and every other doctor I work with on this, that's unacceptable. So we're trying to not only cure DATA2, but we're trying to look at models for how that can be accelerated in any rare disease, certainly a genetic disease that is newly discovered. So it's really a time in medicine where the science is going to push us in medicine to do things maybe a little differently than we've done in the past, because it's unacceptable, as I said, just to say, here's the genetic defect, but I can't help you beyond that.
I really think that's so powerful, and definitely something I identify with just being in the public health field. Dr. Lee, is there anything you want to add in terms of future directions, research, diagnosis, treatment of DATA2?
I think it's really powerful to have this organization, the DATA2 Foundation, and similar to the Vasquez Foundation, where we get people, both researchers, clinicians, and patients all coming together for a single purpose. You know, thinking back, as a fellow, I read the paper when it first came out, and I thought to myself, I'll probably see this, right? It's such a rare disease. You know, I had a patient just a few months after that, and now I'm sort of involved in this network where we know of at least 400 patients across the world at this point with this condition, and probably many more that we have yet to discover. I think the network is going to be really important going forward in identifying both from a cure standpoint, also from a scientific standpoint and understanding this disease as a whole. It's really a wide network because DATA2, like other vascular disease, it's a whole body disease, not just blood vessel, right? So we know neurologists, we have hematologists, you know, rheumatologists, immunologists, many, many teams are involved in this. So we're getting the message out to many other subspecialists now to look out for this condition. And the key also is having the diagnostic tests both at it and also sequencing level available to different parts of the world, which the foundation has done a tremendous job in terms of making arrangements for that to happen. So I think with this type of arrangement as a team moving forward, this is how we're going to be able to solve this puzzle, as well as in many other rare diseases similar to DATA2.
Yeah, it should definitely give just overall in the vasculitis community, the DATA2 kind of intersecting community, just all the other diseases that we see ongoing research for, it should give, I think, a lot of hope, a lot of confidence, just knowing, you know, we're seeing an example of this, as you just, you described, both Dr. Chambers, Dr. Lee, how it's all worked so quickly, and just the way the collaboration and the research can work, and we're seeing the tangible impacts of that. So I feel like, as always, you know, these episodes are great, especially for our, for the listeners we have that are medical professionals who are always trying to learn. And I hope this does kind of shine a light on a definite bright spot in our community as a host. And it's been great to have both of you and Dr. Chambers and Dr. Lee, kind of giving us such an in-depth look into this. It's something I can't say I had ever heard of before we were introduced to both of you and had this, you know, this topic come up on our podcast, but I feel like it's something that it seems like it's going in really in one direction and it's the right one. So I want to thank both of you for coming on. And again, like I mentioned, DATA2.org is the foundation website. And we're certainly wishing both of you nothing but the best as your research continues. And like I said, certainly seems like it is going in that right direction.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Kaylee.
Thank you, Ben, Kaylee. Thank you for having us.
Okay, thanks once again to our outstanding guests for being able to coordinate with us, and a really insightful and very encouraging conversation as well for the development of the foundation and its continuing research. Again, you can visit their website, dada2.org. That is dada2.org. And Kaylee, I feel like this, as always, with many of these, in particular this episode, did help satisfy your nerding out requirement. I guess that is usually a prerequisite to any of our guests, but really great to hear the kind of differing insights, but also collaborative insights from both Drs. Chambers and Lee today.
Definitely. And yes, you're right. It did check my nerdy boxes. So that's great. Yeah, I think really for me, the most fascinating part is that as we talked about on the episode, this is less than 10 years from discovery to really talking about cures. And that's unbelievable. I mean, thinking just about vasculitis, and I think something that frustrates me a lot for some of the other types of vasculitis, particularly ANCA, is kind of this focus on, oh, maybe we'll cure it, maybe we'll cure it. And I think it's kind of up in the air about that. But having something like DADA too, and really seriously being able to talk about cures, it's just awesome.
Yeah. And like, I just think back to, you know, we've had a number of great episodes since our launch back in early March. And, let's think about like the conversation we had with Dr. Madison, you know, a couple months ago and talking about the history of this stuff and just how deep that history goes with the different types of vasculitis. I think I had mentioned it on the podcast. This barely scratches the surface of any sort of time frame when you think about from 2014 until now. So, yeah, I absolutely echo everything you say, Kaylee. And it'll be great to see just how the development continues. It's obviously nice that the Vasculitis Foundation has been able to partner up with the DADA2 Foundation as well. So all great stuff. As always, want to thank our sponsors, GSK and Genentech, for helping us put on this episode. We are going to be taking a short little hiatus here as we get into the fall months, and we're just loading up. We've got a bunch of new guests coming. We're going to take some time, get everybody loaded up, and get ready for, I guess, an unofficial, it really was your idea, Kaylee, an unofficial second season, but it's a very professional way to go about it. So I'm impressed that you had the presence of mind to to think about it that way. So it's been an outstanding run so far. As you listen to this today, our 12th episode. Again, you can go and find all of our archived podcasts if you've missed some, if you haven't listened to all of them, available on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen, hear the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. So until we talk again, Kaylee, have a great start to your new job. I am excited for you to see how that all goes.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Absolutely. All right. Well, for Kaylee, I'm Ben. We'll say so long, and we will catch you next time here on the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast.